Hello, it is July 29th, 2015. You are looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 517 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. I apologize for no podcast with Allison Footer on Sunday. She was in Cooperstown. I don't know what was going on there, why she would go to that part of New York. It's not even a lot of people around. Very sparsely populated area. But nevertheless, that's where she was. So for some reason, so busy there, she couldn't talk to me. So we'll be back with her next week. But I am delighted to be what I believe to be the last person, including you, the listener, who does not even have a podcast, to have interviewed Molly Knight about her Dodgers book, which is a New York Times bestseller. It's a terrific book. She's the day that we scheduled this interview, I think she was on NPR, live LA radio or like an LA TV show and SportsCenter. She was like, she scheduled this interview in between that time. Like, meanwhile, like, I think I was wiping the arse of one of my two children at that time. I think that's who that was. Anyway, so I'm delighted to have Molly on. We'll be back with the regular podcast on Monday. Then we're going to start doing some football stuff because it's going to be August. So even the football doesn't start until September this year, but you get my point. But I'm delighted to have Molly on. She is terrific, and I think she's even going to be doing some stuff for Sports on Earth for us. So once this promotion business dies down, which for Molly will probably be never. Anyway, here's Molly. She's awesome. All right, hello, Molly. Thank you for coming on. As you and I discussed before this, I'm honored to have become, I had Jonah Carey come on after his book came out, and I joked that I was the 4,000th person to interview him. I actually think I'm the 6,000th person to interview. I think the day we organized this podcast, you're like, okay, well, I have to go do SportsCenter now. I was like, right, go. Oh, yeah, seriously. Well, I'll get back to me whenever. Like, go ahead. And so, Ozzy, congratulations with all the success of the book. And I mean that in not just as because the book is terrific, but also because, you know, this is – you took a leap of faith with this just personally and professionally. You know, this is something that, you know, you really concentrated on this book. And I think now people are seeing how you concentrated on the promotional side. But I think it gets lost a little bit just like you stopped what you were doing and just concentrated on this book. And I have to say I couldn't be happier that it's paying off.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, it was pretty, in retrospect, I mean, it was pretty nuts to leave a decent paying job in this industry, but I just felt like this group was so unique and it was such lightning in a bottle that I had to go for it.
Did you, and I'm hesitant to get into this too much because I'm getting into another Jonah Carey book. I remember when he was working on his book on the Rays, and you know, and it was kind of his Moneyball thing. It's very well researched and very well done. And then the Rays like lost in the first round of the playoffs, and it's like, oh no. And I know, and I feel like my team is personally responsible for that because the Cardinals have caused
some
trouble. So I'm sorry about that. But
I see Matt Carpenter in my nightmares.
Yeah, well, see, I see him in my dreams in an entirely different
context. No, I see him attacking like my spirit.
But it's funny because to me, you know, that I've heard you talk about this. I'd like to have you get into it a little bit now of the notion of how discouraging that was when it became clear that this season that you were chronicling was not going to end up in the championship, but how ultimately it may have worked out better for the book and even for the sale of the book.
Yeah, it was weird. I so basically what happened was I covered the McCourt divorce for ESPN. I worked for ESPN for 6 years, and they sent me out to LA, and then they went to bankruptcy and all that mess, and then I covered the sale, and this was before ESPN launched their regional network, so I was sort of their little point person, and I was going from the courthouse to the clubhouse every day, and so that's kind of how I got to know the players. And it was actually like normally players are like way more elevated than it's like a caste system, and they're up here and reporters are down like in the gutter. But I actually, because they were worried their checks weren't gonna clear. I actually like had information that they needed, so or they wanted, so it was like more of a give and take. So rather than like, oh, get away from me, it was like, oh hey, there's that girl again. Like, let's ask her what she knows, and you know, it was like it was kind of like an even exchange of information, I guess. And when you go through something like that, you it's just, it's sort of like being like trapped in an elevator together with somebody for like 18 hours. Like there's just like this sense of camaraderie later, like you survived something insane. And as soon as Magic Johnson's group came in and spent all that money to buy the team, and they went out and got all those stars, a couple of the guys who had been around were like, you should write a book about us. And Moneyball had just come out. So I think they thought like maybe Brad Pitt would play them in the movie or something. Right. And so when I, that was at the beginning of the 2013 season, but I still had my job at ESPN, and I didn't know, I wasn't just going to write a book, like leave my job at that point and write a book, not knowing how the season was going to go at all. And so I was working full time for ESPN, and I was basically just like, writing, doing stuff for them by day, and then at night going over to Dodger games and watching. And they were awful in 2013 to start the season. And I was like, yo, I'm not writing a book about a train wreck. Like, that's just not interesting to me. And then all of a sudden, you know, they call up Yasiel Puig. They take off and go 42-8. And I was like, okay, maybe I should write about this. But I still hadn't sold the book. It's like totally backward of how most books happen. Usually you write a proposal, especially if you're a first-time author. You write a proposal, your agent takes it out and sells it, and you get an advance, and then you start it. I was just like there, like trying to decide, am I going to do this? Am I not going to do this? And so we kind of developed a strategy. Like by the end of the season, it was pretty clear by just the stuff that had happened, the remarkable characters, Zach Greinke and Matt Kemp, Hanley Ramirez, Yasiel Puig, Clayton Kershaw, and just all the stuff that happened. My agent basically said, why don't you just write an email or open a Word document and just write down a list of all the crazy things that happened this year. And he took and all the different things that would be in this book. And we were so paranoid to put it in an email because we thought it would leak or something would happen and the whole book would be blown. So he walked it into different publishing houses and like had people read the stuff, and then like took it away. It was almost like as if it was like classified information or something. We were so paranoid. And and this was happening actually while the Dodgers were playing the Cardinals in the NLCS. And I was like in St. Louis in my hotel room doing interviews with phone interviews with different editors from different publishing houses were interested. Yeah. And I did my last interview was with Simon & Schuster, and I just had this feeling about the editor I spoke with, and his name's Bob Bender, and he'd done a lot of sports books. And there was something in his voice that just, it seemed very kind to me, which is the character trait I value most in a human. And also I could just tell he's a Yankee fan, and he grew up, he was a huge Don Mattingly fan. And I could just tell that, if I was lucky enough that he would bid on the book, that he was my first choice, because I could just tell it wasn't so much that he saw it as like, oh, this is going to make us a ton of money. I could tell he was just like, he loved Don Mattingly, and he was interested. And it would be like, I don't know, I wanted somebody who would be passionate about it. And then they lost. Kershaw collapsed, and I had a meltdown and was like, oh my gosh, now no one's going to buy the book. Like, I'm pretty much devastated. And like, flew home, stayed in my bed for like 2 days. And then
I almost feel bad about the Cardinals winning now. I don't, but I almost feel bad.
Yeah, dragged myself out of bed to go to that press conference where Don Mattingly like went rogue.
Yeah,
as I was walking into that press conference, I get a call from my agent saying that Simon & Schuster made an offer and that it was a really good offer. And I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. And that's sort of how it went. Some people are like, oh, why'd you write a book about a bad season? It's like they don't understand that you can't retroactively be like, oh, the Dodgers won the World Series last year, and now I'm going to go back and be in that locker room. You know, you can't do that. And I think people can relate to, unfortunately, most people can relate to the agony of defeat more than like being world champions. So, and being resilient from that, and you know, how you persevere and realize it is just a game, you know, like, so yes, that's my long-winded answer to that. Sorry.
Well, no, please. This is a podcast, but this is all for long wind. So one of the many things I like about the book, I feel like there's two, the book is consistent all the way through, but there's two things I think it's particularly good at. One is painting scenes. There's some really, like, you're just very, just net, like, regardless of a sport, whether you care about the Dodgers or not, you're very good at constructing a scene and telling a story, which I think is the key to writing. But another thing I love about it is, you know, everybody, when it comes to guys like Matt, two guys in particular, Mattingly and Puig, we have all had so many conversations on each side, on both of them. You've had, for Mattingly, you had the sabermetric strategy people being like, he's really bad at, like, in-game right. strategy. And then you had the baseball people being like, he's John Mattingly. We admire this guy. He's a leader of men, and so on. And all of us all had all of these conversations. I certainly have done that. And Puig the same way. Puig, Sam Metrics are like, he's got all this talent. Why in the world are they playing Ether over him in this game?
Right.
You know, why this guy's the most talented guy out there. And then you have the people being like, he's a hothead. He doesn't know how to play. He doesn't, and so on.
Right.
And one of the things I love about the book is I feel like it is impossible to read the stuff about Mattingly and Puig and not come away from the book being like, wow, all of us people that were yelling about this had no idea what we were talking about on either side. I feel like that's a sign of a well-reported book that, like, and frankly, you having the space and freedom to be able to actually tell the actual story as opposed to the little nibbits that kind of come out to the public. Do you, when... I'm sure, you know, when the first kind of things came out about the book, it was like, oh, see, this proves the thing about Puig, and oh, nope, turns out he's like this on, and I feel like that's a good sign. Oh, well, those people have just not read the book yet.
Right.
And I realized, wow, most people just don't read the book when it comes to understand what's actually going on. Did you feel this need in that situation? Because you're aware of the outside narrative of these things, even when you're covering them. Did you feel the need to, like, set the record straight on that, or is that just kind of like something that comes out of the natural kind of narrative process?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tried to approach this as, I remember when I sold the book and Bob, my editor, asked me, okay, there's going to be some stuff in here. You know a lot of stuff. Like, you know a lot of things that are confidential or sensitive or may not paint somebody in a flattering light. Like, are you going to be okay? How are you going to feel about being that person who shares those things? And I always said, look, I get that. I know that, like, not everything is rosy, but that's how life is. And as long as I feel that I can be fair and present these people not as good or bad, but as human, then I've done my job. And I want to sort of remain as neutral as possible. It's funny. There was one review. The reviews have been, like, almost universally amazing, although I don't really read that stuff. It's just like when my mom sends me something and then I'm like, Mom, I told you not to send me even the good stuff. I don't want to, like, I don't know. I don't want to, whatever. I don't want to get dragged down by the trolls, and I don't want to buy into the hype either. There was one review where, like, the person was like, oh, it's almost too neutral. And I'm like, okay, well, I take that as a compliment, because it's not my job really to, I can tell you what I observed, and I can show you a moment where somebody acted like an ass, but I can also try to, on the next page, explain, maybe give some context of where that person was coming from, and let the reader decide, oh, yeah, like, I totally would, if I were Matt Kemp, like, I totally would have been pissed off if I had been promised I was starting on opening day after rehabbing for, like, 6 months after having a misdiagnosed injury, and I showed up and my name wasn't in the lineup. I would totally throw a fit and say, trade me to the effing Astros, you know? Like somebody who would feel that way, or somebody who's like, that's unprofessional. Like, you know, it's just, it's not up to me to make that decision. It's just, I just wanted to be an observer and paint the story. And yeah, no, it was really hard. I struggled with that.
First off, like, your moms always even send the bad stuff. Like, that's something I've noticed about my mother. Whenever I'm in the middle of some kerfuffle, as anyone that does anything publicly online, she'll go ahead. If I'm ignoring the bad stuff, she'll inform me. I can't really get away from it.
Yeah, I know. I don't know what it is about moms. They're just like, I don't know if they don't, like, read it, and they just think, like, oh, your name, here you are, you know, your grandma's running out to the store. And I'm like, actually, that was, like, a weird thing that I don't like. It doesn't matter, you know. Yeah. Like, your name, you're here, they wrote about you, and I don't know.
Yeah, I had to totally calm down. I'm friends with Tommy Craig's mother, and I totally had to calm her down.
I think I knew that you were friends with her.
Yeah, because she's from Champaign. She's from Champaign, Illinois.
Right.
And when they did the roast on Deadspin on his last day, I interviewed her for, like, stories about it.
I read that. That's right.
Yeah, uh-huh. And this September, like, our families are going to a game together. Like, it's very outside of the construct of all of this online junk that's out there. We actually are, like, you know, real life friends as opposed to online friends. But so you can imagine what the last week of her week and a half of her life.
Oh my gosh, I love Craig. How is he?
He's doing, he's fine. Like, you know, I think as any reasonable person would do, they're staying off the internet as right now. And I mean, what good does Tommy to go on and see people that have never heard the name Tommy Craig's in their lives? all of a sudden now this is all the information about that I have them. To me is, I know. I understand it. I get it, and I actually understand why people are upset. But certainly, you know, I think that he's Tommy.
Regardless of how anybody feels about any of the Gawker stuff or whatever, like, he is such a fine writer and journalist that, and I don't think people realize that. I think, I don't know, not even get into any of that, but I mean, there was a time at ESPN where he was like fact-checking my stories, and I was like, this is personally embarrassing. Like, I am personally embarrassed that somebody who is way more talented than me is sitting here, like, fact-checking my stuff. Like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, he's he will, like, land on his feet wherever he goes because he's
a genius.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
He's brilliant.
I remember when DeLorio was running Deadspin, he was trying to get Craggs on to come on the board of the team. And DeLorio, I'd never talked to Tommy at that point. And DeLorio called me and said, hey, you have to come out to dinner with me tonight. I'm meeting with Tommy Craggs, and he thinks I'm a skis ball. And so he wants to make sure you come to make sure that we're not – that not everyone involved with Deadspin's a jerk. And I was like, all right. So I got to play good cop for the night. Actually, my entire friendship with AJ is mostly being good cop.
He's doing okay.
So I don't mean to get sidetracked on that, but like
– No, but it's important. I mean, it was a really big thing, and I don't really have an opinion either way on it. It's a very convoluted issue, but as far as Craggs goes, I'm a huge fan of his work.
Yeah,
so.
It's pretty hard. Yeah, I find if you're not a big fan of Craggs' work, you just have read it.
He had the greatest lead of all time in the history of sports journalism with that Joe Morgan story.
Oh,
so
and he did that story like 10 years ago. He did it like pre Moneyball. It's really kind of amazing.
Yeah, he was like, I feel like he must have been like 22 when he wrote that story, because I think we're the same age, or 21. He was a pup, and
right. It's very annoying. I stopped being annoying about it. Now I'm just like, okay, the way that, like, Stephen King wrote about this book, and the one writing helpful book I've ever read was actually Stephen King's On Writing, because it's not about find your happy snow, your happy field to find your happy place. It's like, stop using so many adverbs.
Yeah.
Every sentence is active, not passive. Like, it's just practical things. So
it's so funny you say that, because I did the same thing, and I went through my book after my after I wrote the first draft. I literally was scanning through each chapter. I was just searching for LY at the end for adverbs, but the problem was I realized, like, two of my main characters were named Mattingly and Scully. And so I was like, this is actually
the worst. Never mind. This isn't going to work.
Like, I have like two characters, main characters, who are adverbs, and like, this is
yeah, that is and it's right, cause but I remember him talking about the idea that he's like, listen, everyone kind of realizes early on in their life, if they're a writer, that, like, you know, I feel like I'm pretty good, but then you see that guy and you're like, oh, that guy or that woman, they're so much better than me that I just can't ever approach that. So then it's a matter of dealing with, okay, can I just be the best I can and be happy with that? Or am I going to drive myself crazy? The Salieri idea. Like, am I going to drive myself crazy trying to become the best? So I've made my peace with Craggs that, and I try to explain this to his mom, but she's like, why is everybody so mad? And I'm like, the context to this is too much to explain.
Well, she just needs to stay off the internet. Yeah, I tell her that. Moms don't know that. So I'm glad my mom's like, sort of internet literate, I remember it was a big deal when she started like texting and doing like sending pictures and stuff, but like, she doesn't have a Facebook, and like, she doesn't know what Twitter is or anything. So it's great. I don't think she like knows about Google alerts, thank God. So it's pretty good.
Yeah, I remember when all my family, all my parents and their siblings, I only have two parents, but my parents and their siblings all discovered they could email each other, and they live out all across the country. And so they're like, oh, so like, the 5 years afterwards, they've realized what we all learned, which is that email is actually a very efficient way for families to fight.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So, like, after that, I was like, Mom, see, this is what I mean. This is why you have to be careful with this. So it's why my dad has no idea that the Cardinals are hated, and I'm so happy about it.
That's great. That's great. Well, if Tommy Craggs' mom is listening, just, stay off the internet. It's all going to blow over.
Exactly.
Just and or to feel better, like read the news about Donald Trump, and then you know put things in perspective.
Yeah, that's a good sign. That's a good sign of how rough the last week and a half has been for Tommy. His mother reading about Donald Trump is actually probably a good thing. It's a
yes,
to make you feel better about the world. Okay, one thing I want to ask you about your book too that I find really fascinating. Ned Coletti is obviously a major character in the book, and kind of not so much a major character as much as the backdrop to a lot of things. And it's interesting because I was listening to the baseball. I don't know if you heard the Baseball Perspectives podcast when they talked about your book, and they kind of talked about how in any other context, we sabermetric people or higher people from unconventional backgrounds would love Ned Coletti. You know, he's like a PR person,
right?
Like works himself up through the system, but because of that, I think doesn't have the respect of a lot of players, as you kind of get across the book.
Right.
But there are certain times I think you give him a nice shading, but there are also times where he comes across as a total buffoon. Whereas obviously the Friedman the crew comes in, they seem hyper competent, they seem hyper aware, this seems like everything is rosy because nothing can really go wrong yet. Like it's really right. It's just the first year. And if I may use my Cardinal example here, one thing I've always kind of been taking pride in the card when I saw front offices, particularly during the McCourt days, with the Dodgers or the Mets or the Marlins or the Phillies, like these teams that seem to have these front office discord. Oh, I was like, see, the reason the Cardinals have had success is not because of devil magic. It's because they have a very prudent, cautious, smart front office that does things correctly and is very patient. Mm-hmm. And then they come down with one of the biggest scandals in baseball history. And then you're reminded that, it's just another office like everywhere else. It's just another group of people all working together. They're going to do dumb things because that's what happened in an office. So my question is you spent so much time around all these people. Do you think that as competent as the Friedman or crew seems to be, there's still like it's an office and they're humans and mistakes are going to be made and weird things are going to happen. I think a Dodger fan is going to feel like this new crew and the Magic Johnson ownership group is the balm for the pain of the McCourt Coletti years. But like weird stuff happens and I mean the job is really hard.
Oh yeah, for sure. And like you know they're all it's funny I believe right now in that front office there are five. People who have at one point been a general manager, that Jerry Hunsicker, Stan Kasten, Andrew Friedman, Farhan, Zaidi is now the GM, and Josh Burns. And so, and right now everything's like hunky-dory. They're all getting along. They're all communicating. It's totally, great. But of course, if things don't go well this year or if things don't go well next year, and if their jobs are on the line, of course there'll be tension, and of course there'll you know something could the problem with the last Dodger regime is it was like as I describe in my book one of the problems is there have been so many frustrating seasons that the three sides within the organization in the player development system were all always blaming each other. So there's the drafting side, and then there's the side that's responsible for developing the players once they're drafted, and then there's the GM who decides what to do with those players, trade them, keep them, whatever. And if somebody doesn't pan out, you know, it's like always like, well, it's your fault you traded this guy, and it's your fault you drafted him. Well, you guys didn't develop him. And then it's like got to the point where even certain guys weren't being promoted because they were so-and-so's guy. Yeah. Like, this is Logan White's guy. This is the John Watson's guy. This is whatever. And I mean, that's insane. But like any office, you know, when things aren't going well, politics can take over, and everybody knows what that's like. When someone's idea gets passed over, even if it's the best idea, because the person in charge is mad at them for something, you know, like it's a weird political. So of course, things are all well and good now, but they could obviously take a turn if they don't win soon, and they need to win soon. They haven't been to the World Series in 27 years, so they need to get there this year, or for sure by next year. Or else jobs are going to be in jeopardy already.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that, you know, I think we all have this idea that, you know, the Dodgers are still a work in progress, but obviously they have all this money, they have all this talent, they have Greinke, who I feel like there's so many things I want to ask you about Greinke that I don't know if we have time. But, like, they have all these great – Kershaw and all these great players, and they're still only a half game up.
I know.
Now.
And by the way, the scariest team in baseball is chasing them. The team, like – comes out of nowhere three out of the last 5 years to win, you know, World Series championships. Like the team that somehow, some way does it. So, yeah.
So I'm wondering, is there, you talk about jobs already being in danger, not now, but like how it does feel like with a franchise like this, that's been, you know, that's come so close and not gotten there and not made it to the World Series. And I think with the payroll and the fan base, it's something I think people should reasonably expect. It feels like, and also with the way our culture is now and the way we discuss these things and how quickly the windows are, it feels like the honeymoon period, like, is maybe this year and maybe that or even that. Or do they get more because the McCourt situation was such a mess that people are just happy it's not that anymore?
Well, and also, I think it's not just McCourt. I mean, the Colletti era, when this front office, when this ownership group bought the team, they only had an analytics department of one person. I mean, so they're cleaning up a lot of messes on a lot of fronts. So they're not going to get fired. Farhan and Andrew and John, none of those guys are going to get fired this year if they don't make the World Series. But certainly the pressure is on. And I think in a way it kind of reminds me of when the Red Sox hired Theo to kind of come in and clean it up, and they were sick of watching the Yankees win. It was those two teams every year, and the Yankees kept winning, and the Red Sox hadn't. Obviously, it was longer, 86 years or whatever it was, is longer than 27 years. But in some level, it's the same way, because your division rivals and your rival keeps kicking your ass, and so you go out and get a bunch of smarty pantses and try to figure out how to outwit them that way. And so yeah, well, it makes it interesting. And I think the Dodgers are going to have to get through both the Giants and the Cardinals to get to the World Series, and so they've got to figure out a way to do that.
Now, obviously, you're not spending as much time, if at any. I don't know how you have time to get to the ballpark right now, as much as you've been on this. But so obviously, you're not as close. I know that you've talked to some players. There's been some. You certainly have had reaction on the book on things. But I'm curious, being away this year, which frankly, you know, I mean, it looks like there's still some drama going on this year. The idea that they're talking about, like Puig could potentially be in the trade discussion, and Greinke and Kershaw and all this other business. I'm curious, like, do you, when you're watching, you were so close and so inside for so long, when you're watching, you know, the headlines now, or just hear these things come out, do you feel like you understand them more, or do you feel like an outsider from it already?
Oh no, I mean, I'm still in constant contact with so many players and coaches. I mean, yesterday I did a lunch thing with Farhan, their GM, and last night I was out to dinner with a couple of their executives. I mean, it's one of those things where I kind of feel weird about the fact that, like, I was part of the news story in a way, like that my book was like, oh, Dodger teammates, you know, they all hate Puig, when really a lot of reporters had a little bit of that. I mean, Jeff Passan, who's a fantastic reporter for Yahoo, obviously he had heard a lot of the same things I had heard, but he didn't feel like he had enough sourcing, and so when he got my book and read through it, and some of my stuff matched up with what he had heard, and it filled in the blanks, and it gave him enough to go on. He reported it, and it did cause you know, drama in that locker room. Not because, you know, no one ever denied anything, because everything or every word of it is true. But there's a difference between everyone in your locker room knowing that they don't like Puig, and then the world knowing it. But it got to that point because guys were so frustrated, and they felt like it wasn't getting better, it was getting worse, and they tried everything. So it's like, well, you know, think of the point it would have to get to for multiple players to reach out to multiple reporters.
But even when you talk about in your book, it still doesn't feel like he would be traded. Like, they're all like, we'll deal with it. And you paint it so well about how, like, because the organization was in such chaos when he first got there, and there was also the notion of, like, some of those offenses, like, oh, I'm sorry, he didn't recognize Luis Gonzalez. He was on a freaking boat 6 months ago.
Exactly.
Leave him alone. And so,
yeah, I mean, it's minor stuff. Like, that's the thing. And, like, I was so, it's really hard, and the Puig stuff is so controversial because I was so over all the, like, people who were wagging their fists at him, like, you know, the old white men who were like getting cranky about his bat flips, like, who cares? And being really sensitive to, like, A, this kid is just got here and had to escape, go through a harrowing escape to get here.
A particularly one even for Cuban refugees.
Yes,
particularly
yes,
harrowing.
Yes. And also that's part of it. So there's like inherent like racism that's there. And also the fact that like a lot of these older columnists or whatever are totally out of touch with what fans want. Fans want to be entertained. They love that stuff. They love seeing Puig make a dazzling play or get excited and hit a home run and flip his bat. And they love it. They love the emotion. And I think I would be ashamed to take that stuff away from him. And now, but that being said, so first I was like, I'm going to get to the real story of Puig and I'm going to write this really, sympathetic portrait. Then, like, the more I'm in there and the more that I see confrontations with his own teammates and the fact that, like, it's, like, all they talk about and it sucks up all the oxygen in the room, it's like, wait a minute, okay, I can't write a story about this team and not point this out because it wouldn't be a true book. It would just be, like, a puff piece and it's not based in reality. And like really all that matters, like it doesn't matter what a columnist thinks about Puig or a fan thinks about Puig or whatever. All that matters is what the people in his own locker room think. That's it. Like, because whatever, like who cares? And when he started not hitting, when his OPS went from like 900 down to 700, the stuff got tired. Even though it's not like a Ray Rice situation where he's on camera knocking his fiance out. The stuff, the inattention, the showing up late, the lack of preparation, it just got tired.
Yeah. If he's still bad, so you think if he's got 900, 950 OPS during the season that everyone thought he was going to have this year,
right?
We're not hearing any of this.
No, they would not have filled in the blank. I knew about the Greinke, so I knew about that Greinke altercation because, and I mentioned this in the notes in the book, I was watching that game and Greinke, he just looked really rattled on the mound. They were playing the Cubs and the Cubs were bad and like trotting out a quadruple A lineup. And this was the end of last season. And the first play of the game, he like, I think it was Chris Coughlin or somebody's on base. And Greinke throws the ball over and he just like tosses it into the stands basically or down the line or something. He made a horrible error. And I looked it up and he hadn't made an error in like 5 years. I mean, he's a tremendous athlete and tremendous glove. So I happened to just like, whoa, something's off. Because that's like sad that I would know that because I watch this team so much. And so I text an employee like, what is wrong with Greinke? He looks like he's about to pass out on the mound or something. Something's off. And he says, oh my god, he got into it with Puig last night in front of a bar. But I didn't get the details of what happened until this year, earlier in the year, right before the book went to press, because at that point I had tried, but nobody really wanted to talk about it. And then at that point, they were just so frustrated that the behavior wasn't getting better that they were like, all right, we're ready for this to come out. So that's how I learned about the luggage incident.
And I feel like this speaks once again to your I've usually. Because the thing is, you're a Dodgers fan. Like, I kind of love that. And, like, I feel like that's such a hard thing. I frankly have struggled with it myself. Of, like, how do I write about a team that, you know, is essential, like, has been a part of my life since before me wanting to be a writer was part of my life. And I feel like you've done such a good job with that. And particularly because, you know, my big thing about – I don't want to know, actually, the Cardinals personally. Like, I don't actually want to know them because – because I want to root for them as fan constructs,
right,
as opposed to people. Because maybe it'll make me like some guys more, maybe like some guys less. But like I just don't like the experience I have with the Cardinals is outside, frankly, of the individual personalities of the teams,
right.
of the guys playing for them. That's against my instinct as a reporter. And if I were covering the team as a reporter or writing a book like yours, I feel like I would have to give up that part of myself that I don't know if I'm good. I would be good at doing it. And I think the fact that when we talked about earlier, seeing writers that can do one thing and realizing you can't do that. This is another example. I feel like you've done such a great job of being a fan of the team while still having the reporter's nose for this stuff. So this begs me the question, now that you're not currently writing about the team, this particular team, and you may be again, but when they make the playoffs this year, assuming they make the playoffs,
the
odds are good. Are you just going to chill as a fan? Or are you going to sit in the press box? How are you going to hang out with these guys? What's your for the playoffs this year? What are you doing? Are you going to cover them? Or are you going to just watch them as a fan?
That's interesting. I really hadn't. To be honest, I hadn't even thought about that. I've been so like I don't know. I've been so like dizzy with all this stuff, and now I'm like, well, geez, I hope they make the playoffs because the Giants are right there, and the Mets are getting better, and the Pirates are awesome. The National League, in my opinion, is so much stronger than the American League. I think for me, the book is done. It's like, I mean, spiritually, emotionally, it's done. There are so many different characters now, and I wouldn't pretend to be able. I haven't been in the locker room all year. I've been editing and doing this book and whatever. Because the book was about the last 2013 and 2014, so I wouldn't pretend to be able to like parachute in and know these people. That being said, if they win the World Series, I will write an epilogue. Or if something crazy happens, if they trade Puig or whatever, I will write an epilogue for the paperback. But no, it's done. It's over with as far as like further major reporting goes.
So
I'm watching from home.
You watch from home? Good, good. Or at a bar or like out.
Yeah.
Doing things. Yes.
All right, I'll be rooting for them. I mean, I want them to win. Yeah. I as somebody who wants her grandmother and her great aunts and other people to see them win again in their lifetimes. And for me too, I mean, I know a lot of these guys and known them for years, and I've become attached to some of them personally, and I pull for them as humans. And also obviously it would not hurt book sales for them to win.
So that would help the paperback without
question. Yes, for sure.
But all right, well for crying out loud, I look forward to yet another Cardinals Dodgers in LCS this year.
Me too.
And you know, everyone cheering for you guys. And I have to say, your book did not make me. It will make, if the Dodgers do finally break through and beat the Cardinals, it will make me feel less distraught about
that. Oh, that's so nice of you to say.
Oh, I mean, I'll still be in bed for like 2 weeks, but but for what it's worth. It's seriously an incredibly well done book, and so congratulations on it, and it's bookstores everywhere. Actually, bookstores everywhere. I saw on your Twitter today. It's in one. There's one weird city that's Hawthorne, maybe.
It's so funny how where they are. Like, I don't know how Barnes and Noble does this, but like, just if you want to go into a Barnes and Noble, if you're old school or whatever, just go online. It's in like you can type in your zip code and it'll show you where it is if it's in stock. But I mean, Amazon's really easy. Yeah. And to me, people ask me, oh, do you get more money from Amazon or Barnes? But it's all the same. Yeah. Just whatever. Yeah. I'm happy.
Easy for
however
you
do it, I'm happy. I'm happy for you to go to the library and check it out. You know, like, it's fine. Yeah. I'm just honored that anyone would read it. So yes, thank you so much to anyone who for your support, and thank you to Will. You're the best.
No, I'm quite obviously not that, but seriously, great work on. Congratulations. I'm happy for all the success, and hopefully there'll continue to be more. So
thanks so much, Will.
All right, so hang around with me. We're gonna play a little trivia after this. The regular listeners have not had trivia for a while. They'll hear this in a couple days, we'll wrap this up and then we'll do trivia. But seriously, thank you, Molly. Everyone go buy the best team money can buy, the Los Angeles Dodgers Wild Struggle to build a baseball firehouse. That would be an interesting thing.
Firehouse. I thought they would sell a lot of calendars.
That's true. And I don't know if I would trust a baseball player to actually put out an inferno. But, you know.
Airmen and baseball players were like my favorite things. Two favorite things as a kid. I totally would have had like Mike Piazza in a fireman outfit. Like,
he could have been. I can see Piazza as a fireman.
Oh, yeah. He would have been into it. Yeah.
But I'm not sure, like, you know, I don't know if Hershiser is a fireman. But, all right, so thank you to Molly Knight. Please follow her on Twitter at Molly_Knight, MOLLY_KNIGHT. This is a Willie's Experience podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We'll be back in a day or two with the Molly Knight Trivia podcast that we're actually going to tape right now. Be safe out there.